Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Lots of politics and policy to discuss today. In a bit, we'll debate the merits of a wealth tax, a favored policy proposal from both Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. But first, to politics and yesterday's major moment in the House impeachment inquiry. William Taylor, U.S. Chargé d'Affaires to Ukraine, laid out his opening statement regarding President Trump and Ukraine, 15 pages of detailed, careful testimony that asserted there was a quid pro quo between the White House and Ukraine regarding investigating the Bidens, including Taylor's testimony that President Trump wanted Ukrainian President Zelensky, quote, in a public box by making a public statement about launching such an investigation. So let's dive into this. And joining us from Washington, we have Mike Lillis, senior reporter for The Hill. He'll talk about the latest from Congress. So welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Well, so first of all, tell us a little bit more about what Taylor has offered in his testimony. How much more detail is he giving us from what we've known over the past couple of weeks?
Well, you know, based on the opening statement, which leaked very early in this process, it was just a few minutes after he went into the door, and so it was very clear that he wanted this out there. And it's quite damning testimony that, as you said, that Trump wanted a foreign country to open investigations into his political rivals, and he leveraged two things to try to get that done. And, you know, in short, Donald Trump and his allies have said that there is no quid pro quo. They've said it over and over again over the course of this month-long investigation. Bill Taylor said very clearly that no, yes, there was, and here's the evidence that lays out how this happened. And as you said, again, he took very meticulous notes. He has delivered those to the State Department, and there is no doubt that Congress and Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff are going to want to get their hands on those documents as well. That'll offer a lot more detail than just the 15-page opening statement, which is all we've seen to this point. But this puts Trump in a box. I think, you know, he said that Zelensky would be in a public box. Trump is now in a box. It's his word against this career diplomat, and he's taken all of these notes. And if he delivers them to Congress, then buckle up. We've got a fight on our hands.
Now, Mike, let's dig into this a little bit more because, for example, Taylor goes into quite a bit of detail regarding what he calls an irregular policy channel, effectively run by Rudy Giuliani and Ambassador Sondland. I mean, we haven't seen this level of detail about the activities of Giuliani and Sondland before, have we?
No, we've heard whispers about it. We have heard testimony suggesting as much. You know, when Marie Yovanovitch was here just last week, she was the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. She was removed in May over concerns that Giuliani was running sort of a shadow State Department and was trying to pressure foreign leaders, to jump into these investigations that would have helped Trump's campaign. So very politically motivated, it would seem. And her testimony was also fairly damning, but it wasn't delivered in this much detail, at least that we've seen. The transcripts, we think, will come out later, but we haven't seen the transcripts, and so we don't know exactly what was said. So to say that we haven't, that no one has delivered this type of detail, we don't know the answer, but certainly it hasn't been made public, and that is why everybody's sort of in an uproar this week. And if you listen to the Democrats coming out of Bill Taylor's deposition yesterday, they seem to say that this is the smoking gun without using those words. You know, they said this is the most damning testimony that we've heard so far. Someone described it as a sea change in the process. And Stephen Lynch from Massachusetts suggested that this could actually accelerate the process because the Democrats now have exactly what they need.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of that reaction that you're talking about, Mike. Here's freshman Congressman Andy Levin, a Democrat from Michigan. Here's what he said.
All I have to say is that in my 10 short months in Congress, it's not even noon, right? And this is my most disturbing day in Congress so far.
Now, Mike Lillis, In the language of a career diplomat, usually they are very careful, right, not to assert, not to inject politics into statements like this. But I was quite taken when Taylor writes that he felt that this sort of informal channel, this informal policymaking channel, was actually acting in opposition to longstanding U.S. policy. I mean, my sense is that for a diplomat, those are pretty strong words.
Extremely strong words. And what you're seeing, you know, yes, the career diplomats are usually very careful. They don't like to get involved in the politics, and that's to their advantage, obviously. These guys serve under, various administrations of both parties, and they want to be seen as neutral arbiters of U.S. foreign policy and not let the politics encroach on any of that. That's an important element of the State Department, and it's why they seek to remain sort of autonomous. But what you saw, even going back to the Marie Yovanovitch testimony, she was very curt about, you know, the detrimental effects that this whole episode is having on the State Department. It's an erosion of morale. People think that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, is leaning too far towards Trump and not, you know, defending the career diplomats enough. And that's why these guys are coming up to, you know, they're defying the blockade that Trump is trying to put on these witnesses, on the documents, and they're testifying under subpoena, but they're sort of friendly subpoenas, right? The State Department says you can't testify. The Democrats issue a subpoena, and they come in, and they're singing like birds. And you got to think that they are trying to protect the institution because, you know, Bill Taylor doesn't seem to have any kind of legal involvement in this. You know, he's not under scrutiny for any of this. He has threatened to quit over it. So it's not like he's trying to save himself in this case. He's trying to save the institution that he spent his life working for.
Okay. Now, a little bit more about that public box part, because, again, it's the level of detail here, which is just so eye-opening, that Taylor says that Ambassador Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, said that told him that everything was dependent on everything, you know, in a meeting with the president, the $400 million in assistance, that it was all dependent on the Ukrainian president making this announcement, making an announcement about investigating that company, Burisma, and the Bidens, and that President Trump wanted Zelensky in a public box by making a public statement about ordering such investigations. And later on, we even read that they had discussed Zelensky going on CNN in order to do this.
That's right. Yeah, you know, and that part was not a surprise because if you looked at the text messages that were released a couple weeks ago, that was Kurt Volker. Mm-hmm. He was the former U.S. envoy to the Ukraine, and he came up, testified. He gave Congress a series of text messages between himself, Gordon Sondland, and Bill Taylor, and they revealed very clearly that Volker and Sondland were both pressing Zelensky to make that public statement, and they were sort of dangling a meeting with Donald Trump to get what they wanted. So for Bill Taylor to come up to Capitol Hill and kind of amplify that message was not a surprise. He provided some more details, but the episode didn't change. That part's not a surprise. And Sondland, of course, came up and testified just last week. He said that he had regretted making some of those offers. He didn't deny them, but he did say there was no quid pro quo directly with the U.S. military aid. And so there was a discrepancy there between Bill Taylor and Gordon Sondland. And one of the things that most striking out of yesterday was that a lot of Democrats seemed to think that Sondland was not, he was less than open, less than sincere in his testimony. And some of them want Gordon Sondland to come back and testify again and to iron out some of the discrepancies with Taylor's testimony. So we'll have to see, you know, does this prolong the process now if previous witnesses have to come back? Does it accelerate the process, as Stephen Lynch said, because they have the smoking gun? These are all kind of balls in the air and questions that we have looking forward.
All right. Well, let's hear briefly from a tape from a couple of Republicans about how they're reacting to the release of Taylor's testimony or his opening statement yesterday. Here's Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, a Republican, insisting that the Democratic reaction to Taylor's testimony is overblown.
The president has been very clear that there is not this linkage of aid to any future election activity. And the most important factual development, actually, I understand, came from questions from Congressman Ratcliffe. He asked, well, is there any Ukrainian who we can point to at any moment in time who knew that this aid was even on a hold?
First of all, Mike, can we point to a Ukrainian who knew that this aid was on hold? It seems like Taylor's opening statement says we can.
Yes, Taylor's opening statement says that we can. Now, he's not naming names just yet, but I'm sure those were the questions that were asked after the opening statement was made, and so we'll have to await the transcripts. But, you know, the Democrats counter, again, the smoking gun with Taylor goes back all the way to the, you know, to the whistleblower, to the transcript that the White House itself released between Donald Trump and President Zelensky, Yovanovitch's testimony, and Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, who was on TV last Thursday and seemed to suggest, yes, there was a quid pro quo. So, you know, as the accumulation continues, as the statements come out, they seem to be pointing in that direction. And the Democrats at this point are just kind of say, you know, they're taking it for granted that this has happened. And now the question is, how do we react? They're beyond the question of whether this did, in fact, happen. And the Republicans, it's important, I think, to notice, are really focusing on the process here more than the substance. Matt Gaetz's comments aside, that's the first time we've heard a lot of the substance of this.
Mike, let me just jump in here because I want to play tape from how another very powerful Republican on the Hill reacted. Here is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking with CBS's Nancy Cordes yesterday.
The president has said that you told him that his phone call with the Ukrainian president was perfect and innocent. Do you believe that the president has handled this Ukrainian situation perfectly?
We've not had any conversations on that subject.
So he was lying about that?
You'll have to ask him. I don't recall any conversations with the president about that phone call.
Mike Lillis, we've just got about 30 seconds here. So when you hear Mitch McConnell trying to take a half step back there, while also supporting the president, what does that mean?
It means that he's being very consistent. You know, he has been critical of the president on certain issues. You've seen it on the most recent Syria troop pullout, but he has been very careful not to go after the president on anything. He is up for re-election in 2020, and the base is still much behind Donald Trump, and Mitch McConnell is going to need him both to get legislative things done and to get reelected.
Well, Mike Lillis is a senior reporter for The Hill, speaking to us from Washington. Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan. Happy to be with you.
Well, when we come back, we'll debate the merits of a wealth tax. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about a wealth tax now. Both Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have put wealth tax proposals near the heart of their presidential campaigns. The tax is considered a key to paying for their many proposals. Now, Warren's plan would levy a 2% tax on wealth above $50 million. Sanders' plan would cut deeper, putting in place a graduated tax above $32 million. Here's Senator Warren on her plan.
This would hit, just so you all understand, the top one-tenth of 1% of great fortunes in this country. It's about 70,000 families that would be touched by this.
So basically, Senator Warren sees the wealth tax as a way to tackle inequality. It's the same goal shared by Senator Sanders.
And then you also have three people owning more wealth than the bottom half of American society. That is a moral and economic outrage. And the truth is, we cannot afford to continue this level of income and wealth inequality.
But the question is a wealth tax the best and most effective way to do that? Well, joining me today from New York is Emmanuel Saez, a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-author of The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. He has advised both Senator Warren and Senator Sanders' campaigns on their wealth tax proposals. Professor Saez, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, just make your case here. We'll get into the details in just a moment, but I kind of want to just get your big picture take on why you believe a wealth tax is a critical way to get at this fundamental problem of rampant inequality in America.
Yes. So the most important thing to understand in this debate about wealth taxation is the situation about inequality in the country. So since 1980, inequality has surged dramatically in the United States. So that's true for income and wealth that has really concentrated toward the top. So if you look at the top 0.1% of wealth holders, those families that would be touched by the wealth taxes proposed by Warren and Sanders, their share of total U.S. wealth was only around 7% around 1980, and now it's grown to about 20%. So the top 1,000 families control one-fifth of total U.S. wealth. Contrast that with the bottom 90% of families. So a huge group, you know, 90% of the population that comprises the working class and the middle class. Their share of wealth has come down. And now their share of wealth is only slightly above 20%. So you are in a situation where the top 1,000 has almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. More broadly, if you look at income, you see that the U.S. economy has not worked for the bottom 50%, what we call the working class. Essentially, their incomes have stagnated since 1980. Yeah. While incomes are growing extremely fast at the top. So it's obvious, you know, as President Obama said, inequality is a defining issue of our times in the United States. So we need to think hard about potential solutions.
Right. And so, well, so Professor, if I may, just we're going to talk about the details of the solution. I promise you that we will, because they're really quite fascinating. But I'm looking at, for example, Senator Sanders' plan, right? And I mean, this is the plan that he's put out publicly. So it places things in very stark terms about sort of the nature of inequality in America. The Sanders campaign claims that the three wealthiest people, just the three wealthiest people in the entire United States, own more wealth than the bottom half, the bottom 50% of Americans. So those are very stark terms here. But I wonder, what is it about the particularities of a wealth tax that you believe work better than, say, sort of more straightforward potential policy proposals like fixing the income tax or raising the capital gains tax in America? Why introduce a whole new structure to tackle inequality?
Yes, so this is a very good question. So, and what we describe in our book is indeed how the current U.S. tax system works. And what we find out when we put together all taxes at the federal, state, and local level is that essentially all income groups pay about the same rate relative to their full economic income, so around 25 to 30%, with an exception at the very top, the top 400. So think about them as billionaires. Actually, in 2018, we estimate pay a lower rate than the other groups of only 23%. So why is that? That the current tax system doesn't succeed in taxing the very rich. Well, the individual income tax is progressive, but it is based on realized income. Mm-hmm. And if you are a very wealthy person who, say, owns a corporation, so think about Warren Buffett, who owns a large fraction of Berkshire Hathaway, you may not need to realize income. That is, the profits of the firm can stay in Berkshire Hathaway, in which case no income shows up on your individual tax return. And I mentioned Warren Buffett because he gave those numbers. So in 2015, his wealth was $65 billion. Mm-hmm. Income on that wealth was likely, 5% of that, so probably something like $3 billion. Yet his reported income was only $10 million because he just sold a few shares. He didn't need much more income, so his federal income tax liability was just minuscule. And that's why the very wealthy, if they don't need the income immediately, essentially can defer the income tax. The corporate tax has now been cut a lot with the Trump tax cut, so the liability there has come down a lot. In contrast, if you think about a wealth tax, it goes directly after the accumulated wealth and would be a very powerful tool to increase, again, tax progressivity in the United States. So we've crunched the numbers. We've developed a tax simulator that accompanies the book, taxjusticenow.org. You can play with the numbers, but you very quickly see that if you put a wealth tax like Senator Warren or Sanders have proposed, you really increase dramatically the tax rates at the very top, especially in the billionaire class. So just with the Warren wealth tax, is enough to double the tax rate on billionaires from the current 23% low up to 46%. With the Sanders wealth tax, you crank up the tax rate on billionaires by a factor of 3, like something like 70%. Now, you can play also with the income tax, as you said, taxing better capital gains, but still you will always face the problem that the very wealthy can defer realizing those gains, and therefore it doesn't change nearly as much the tax rates on the very top.
Well, there one alternative take on this whole idea of a wealth tax or a criticism of some of your work, Professor Saez, is, well, maybe a quicker change would be to not allow the deferral of the realization of the gains. Like, just change that so that when the gain is actually realized, that the taxes take into account all the time that that money wasn't actually taxed by the government. I mean, it's a wonky solution. I get it. It's not as easy to wrap your head around as saying we're going to slap a 2% tax on everything above $50 million. But could it possibly be more effective?
Our view is that the tax are by the people, for the people, and the people need to understand the tax system. That's what our book is about, presenting taxes in a way people can understand. And certainly the wealth tax has a lot of virtue. It's obvious to all our auditors that the wealth tax, above $50 million would really target the rich. Now, it's true that the income tax has weaknesses, loopholes that we are all in favor of closing, and in particular, the taxation of capital gains doesn't work very well. So we are in favor of closing this. We're saying it wouldn't be enough, and also it wouldn't probably generate enough public enthusiasm, because it's a technical fix on the income tax. So it's good for experts like myself, Larry Summers, to debate that, but it wouldn't clearly flag, that we are going to solve the problem of excess concentration of wealth in our country.
Okay. Well, you mentioned Larry Summers. I will introduce him in a moment because we will have that debate, Professor Saez. But first, let me just take a quick call here. Let's go to Laura, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Thank you. And thanks for the show today. There's lots of ways to equalize wealth in this country, but I feel like if we don't address our actual tax system and rules, then even implementing this kind of idea of a wealth tax is going to be very difficult. They've tried it in Europe in many, many countries, and it didn't work. Compliance was an issue, and even today we have, compliance issues. But basically, all of it's legal. I mean, tax inversions and tax havens are all legal. So I think if we don't address that, then it's very difficult to have the structure and compliance to actually do a wealth tax. And mm-hmm. I kind of agree with a wealth tax, but I'd like to know how the guest, how would America with, we can barely get our poop in a group when it comes to our tax system now. How are we going to do that?
Right.
Wealth
so Laura, yep. Thank you for your call, Professor Saez, the implementation challenge here.
Yes, Laura, thank you. Those are excellent points. And certainly, for progressive taxation to work, it needs to be designed well so that it's very difficult to avoid or evade, and it needs to be enforced well. The point we make in our book is that this is possible. And we say that not as, you know, pie in the sky, hope for the future. It's because we've also looked at the history of taxation. And actually, the United States is really the country that invented very progressive taxation in the 1930s. That is, before any other country, the U.S. set very, very high tax rates on income and inheritances. And it worked for decades. And the reason it worked, it's because when those taxes were put in place, society and government made sure they would be enforced. And then the system unraveled, you know, when the monitoring, the enforcement weakened. So it's obvious that if you want the wealth tax to be successful, you need good enforcement mechanisms. So I agree with Laura and others that say that wealth taxes in Europe haven't worked well, but we've looked at the experience and thought very hard about the issue, and we think a well-designed wealth tax could work. The weakness of the European wealth taxes is that they were easy to avoid and evade. If you moved from Paris to London, after a year, you were no longer liable for the French wealth tax. In contrast, in the U.S., the tax follows you wherever you are because it's based on citizenship, and there is a huge exit tax if you renounce your citizenship.
Well, so, Professor Saez, you're saying that we would chase the money wherever it is in the world, and point well taken there. But stand by for just a moment, because I did promise a vigorous debate about this concept or proposal for a wealth tax. And joining us now from San Francisco is Larry Summers. He is former U.S. Treasury Secretary. He served under President Clinton. He's former director of the National Economic Council for President Obama, former president of Harvard University as well. Larry Summers, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be with you.
So first of all, I mean, you do have a detailed critique of Professor Saez's proposals and plans here, or his ideas. But I want to ask you the same, sort of the flip side of the same big picture moral question that I began our full conversation with. Because when we talk about inequality in America, Mr. Summers, we're talking about wealth inequality, not strictly income inequality. So what is the moral argument against a wealth tax?
Some large part of the argument is that it simply is a riverboat gamble with the future of the American economy in terms of what it would mean for our continued prosperity, in terms of whether it would actually generate revenue for the government on a substantial scale, in terms of whether it would enable the financing of a large set of social initiatives that we need, in terms of whether the numbers would add up in a way close to that that Professor Saez suggests. These are all riverboat, these are all highly speculative questions, and my reading of the evidence suggests otherwise. There's a long tradition of what might be called campaign economics, proposals put forward during campaigns without scorekeeping by people who are professional at it, but supported by professors who've written books, that then dematerialize when a president attempts to implement them. And this is a moment when we as a country can't afford to have the kind of thing happen that happened to President Clinton's health care plan that deferred national health insurance for our country for 20 years. And take those kinds of risks. There are ways of strengthening enforcement, closing loopholes in the income tax that will be as progressive, raise substantially more revenue, put the economy at less risk, and be much more likely to actually happen.
Well, President Summers, may I ask you?
That's the direction that should be the focus of progressive tax reformers.
But you talk about a riverboat gamble here at the U.S. economy. There's also a long tradition of analysts, policymakers, and the ultra wealthy, anytime there's a suggestion to increase their tax burden in any way, shape, or form, the first thing they do is they stand behind the body of the U.S. economy and say, don't shoot, because you're going to take down the U.S. economy. And yet that has not, when has that directly happened? I can't, where in U.S. history has an increase in taxes on the ultra wealthy taken down the U.S. economy?
We have so far avoided making the kinds of mistakes that are implicit in these proposals. So you're right that the tax increases we've had in the past, we haven't had very many tax increases, have not been the cause of taking down the American economy. And look, there are all the people who opposed President Clinton's tax increases on the wealthy in 1993, or President Obama's tax increases in during his presidency, would also oppose the closing of all the loopholes, reform of capital gains taxation, making the estate tax a serious tax. Once again.
Yeah. Larry Summers, stand by for a second. I'm only interrupting here because we do have to take a really quick break. I'll let you finish that thought. When we come back, we are debating a wealth tax this hour on Point. I'm joined by Larry Summers and Professor Emmanuel Saez as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are debating the merits and practicalities of a wealth tax this hour. And I'm joined today by Emmanuel Saez. He's co-author of the book, The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. He has advised both Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren on their wealth tax proposals. Larry Summers joins us as well from San Francisco. He's former Treasury Secretary for the United States, former Director of the National Economic Council for President Obama, former President of Harvard University as well. And Larry Summers, we had to take a quick break there and I had to jump in on you, but go ahead and complete your thought about why a wealth tax might come at the expense of the U.S. economy.
There are ways of making the tax system much more progressive and raising much more revenue that are more reliable that they will get the revenue, more reliable that they will be legally allowed to go into practice, more reliably that the money will come from people who actually have the cash or and are in a position to pay it. The wealth tax that Emmanuel proposes is the triumph of hope over experience. The estate tax is basically a wealth tax. It's easier to collect because we only collect it every 25 years or so when a family has a death, and it's very, very substantially avoided. The wealth tax has been tried extensively in Europe, and more than three-quarters of the people who had it decided to get rid of it. The wealth tax is, in the judgment of most experts, likely, rightly or wrongly, to get declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. And the wealth tax raises all kinds of fundamental problems. It's easy to say people should give up 2% of their wealth, but many people have what are called illiquid assets. Sure, if you have stock, you could say you could sell the stock, but people own private companies. People own private real estate assets of one kind or other. You can't really start selling off a share of those. People don't have the cash, and that's the beginning of why these taxes have largely been avoided every place else. And the thing that Emanuel says that just isn't right for people who know the history is that somehow in some glorious old day when the United States had 90% tax rates, we were some kind of progressive paradise. No, we weren't. Everyone who earned a lot of income had incorporated themselves, got their income in the corporation, and that's why it didn't show up in the tax return.
Well,
they
Mr. Summers,
all kinds of personal deals to compensate themselves in ways that weren't taxed. Mm. We didn't raise any appreciable amount of revenue
with
our 90% tax rate.
So, Mr. Summers, you've presented a lot of counterpoints here to Professor Saez. Let me just give him a chance to respond. And
sure.
Professor Saez, let's pick up with the thought that Larry Summers just left us with, that is, the rich have a long history of behaving badly when it comes to paying taxes, so why try?
Yes, well, in our book, we take the deeper historical view and we document how much each group was paying in taxes, not only counting the individual income tax, but also the corporate tax and all taxes. And in our data, very clearly, we see that when the U.S. went very seriously, you know, as the first country in the world to do it, to crank up enormously tax rates on individual income, on corporation, it changed dramatically the picture. That is, in the 1950s, for example, the individual income tax rate was at a maximum of 90%. And it's true that the very rich didn't realize that much income, but we also had a huge corporate tax that was taking in more than 50% of corporate profits in taxes. Today, we are down to 16%. So when you stack up those taxes, we do find that in the 1950s, upper-income groups paid, you know, over 60% of their true economic income in taxes. Today, we are down to 23%. And I would also say that I don't oppose the fixes that Larry Summers is proposing. And some of those have been tried in Democratic administrations in the past, you know, increasing a little bit the top tax rates, perhaps improving the taxation of capital gains. But this is not going to solve our inequality problem, because if you look at the last 40 years, you find inequality rising inexorably, and the little fixes we are discussing or that were on the table, you know, in those debates are not going to solve it. In contrast, look at what happened in the first part of the 20th century when the U.S. really imposed very progressive taxation, well enforced. There we did see a dramatic reversal in inequality, and that ushered actually an era of prosperity with very equitable growth in the post-war decades.
Well, Emanuel and his colleagues just don't have the history right as I read it. Many things were going on in the first half of the century. We had the two Roosevelts. We had a whole initiation of antitrust and financial regulation. That a whole different set of issues. All the issues raised by the Bostonian Louis Brandeis around concentrations of economic power. Mm. It wasn't the taxes. And look, here's what happens when you put high tax rates on. When you put high tax rates on, people find ways of earning their income but not putting it on their tax return. And then you look at their tax returns and you think you've had some kind of phenomenal egalitarian success. The reality is that the income has simply avoided taxation by not showing up on tax returns. And that's the judgment of the vast majority of scholars who've studied the tax system. That's why Democratic administrations like John Kennedy's administration in 1964 led the charge to bring the top tax rate down from what people came to realize was a mistaken level of 90%.
Yeah. Well, Larry Summerson, let me just jump in here for a second, because I do want to ask you something, because you said, I mean, yes, we can debate the fact that the ultra-wealthy will go to quite a distance, quite a length to find creative ways to avoid taxes. But that doesn't necessarily mean that perhaps it's bad policy to try. But you also said a second ago that, you know, in the early part of the last century it wasn't the taxes, it was Roosevelt and it was regulation. So it was government spending and regulation. But I guess what folks like Professor Saez would say, what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders both say, is that it would be a wealth tax that would allow for the government spending. What's wrong with that equation?
If a wealth tax was found unconstitutional, it wouldn't permit any government spending.
But that's an
if. If a wealth tax found didn't succeed in raising revenue, as it didn't in 9 out of 12 European countries that have abolished it, it wouldn't generate and permit any substantial level of spending. If a wealth tax proved to be damaging to the economy, because for many people it was a tax rate of more than 100% on their income, it would reduce the government's capacity to spend. So I'm for more progressive taxation to enable crucial public investments in everything from children to health care to greater competitiveness. What I'm against, at a time when we are fighting for our competitiveness, for our economic leadership in the world with China, is an approach that has as its center pitting workers against companies, some Americans against other Americans, rather than focusing on cooperatively making the investments we need to compete and have the stronger economy that's necessary for everybody's prosperity to go up.
All due respect, President Summers, I think there are millions of workers out there who already feel like they have been pitted against corporations. But Professor Saez, I'm sure you have some response that you'd like to offer here.
Yeah, you know, the defining issue in our society is inequality. And I'm sorry to report, you know, to Larry Summers that the U.S. economy has not worked well for the working class. That is, in our estimates, we find that their incomes have stagnated. So Larry Summers might not see it as an urgency, but in our view, that's just not sustainable. And therefore, the policies, you know, that have been tried are not going to solve the problem. You need something different. And our view, again, is that if you want to do progressive taxation, you can. It's true that if you design the tax system poorly, the wealthy will escape taxation, but we really feel that society has the power through its government to impose taxes if it wants to. And we make those points, you know, tax after tax. So we discuss the wealth tax. We see ways, you know, we could overcome the issues that have plagued, you know, the European wealth taxes. We also discuss that for taxing corporations that right now can avoid taxes by booking profits in low-tax jurisdictions. All these have fixes, and we view the role of tax experts really doing our work to find the fixes, yeah, and make sure we have an airtight tax system. And I take on what Larry Summers is telling us, in the sense that we want to hear those objections, but we want to hear them as experts ready, you know, standing at the ready to provide the solutions, not to provide, you know, defeatism and say we cannot do anything.
Well, Professor Saez, though, I mean, in fairness to Larry Summers here, he's bringing the voice of political experience to the table, which is important, because ultimately, you know, if the goals are the same, and in terms of reducing inequality, and you have someone who spent quite a many number of years in government saying, if you want to meet that goal, this plan is not going to get you there because it is politically and practically not feasible. Is that not worth noting that perhaps you're sort of going down the garden path here?
What I hear from Larry Summers are, you know, policies that have been tried, discussed, and what we know, you know, from historical analysis of inequality, it's not going to fix the problem. So my view is that we need fresh ideas that are informed, you know, by the deep history of our country that really invented progressive taxation, and that we believe, you know, based on our long scholarship with Thomas Piketty, played a crucial role in reducing income and wealth concentration in the U.S. and in other countries. We are at a time where income and wealth concentration has grown enormously again, and we need to reinvent progressive taxation for this century.
Well, let me... Larry Summers, just a second. I do have a duty to make a little bit of room for our callers, and I want to at least just get one person in here because I did put the number out, and we've got so many. So let's just go to Jim from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. The best explanation in favor of the wealth tax, which I've heard of, came from Elizabeth Warren. She said that the ultra-wealthy amassed their wealth in part due to infrastructure, which we taxpayers paid for. So based on that, I do agree with the wealth tax. Thanks.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. Larry Summers, would you like to respond? Go ahead.
I want to say two things. First, there is a long history, and the campaign proposals that the wealth tax reminds me most of are George McGovern's, with the same kind of redistributionist emphasis, and that didn't work out very well for the progressive cause as it led to Richard Nixon's reelection. Second, the inequality is a crucial concern, but so is the fact that the American economy is stagnating and may well go into recession next year. So is the fact that our leadership as the largest economy in the world is being threatened in an unprecedented way by China. And if we define our entire economic debate around wages not growing rapidly enough, around a fight between workers and businesses, we're not going to do the kind of thing we did that got us out of the Depression, that won us World War II, and pull together as a country. So the right emphasis is on making sure that taxes are based on the ability to pay and are much more progressive than they are right now. But it's not an emphasis on that salvation for the United States is tearing down the wealthy.
Well,
that was George McGovern's premise.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Yeah. Well, Larry Summers, we've just got 90 seconds left here, so I'm going to say thank you to you, Larry Summers, former U.S. Treasury Secretary and former Director of the National Economic Council and former President of Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Summers.
Glad to be with you.
Emmanuel Saez, we do have about 60 seconds left, so last word goes to you.
Yeah. So what I would say is that, look, during World War II, there was a big task ahead of us. And what did we do? We cranked up tax rates at the very top enormously. We increased the corporate taxes enormously. And the U.S., you know, won the war and really was the dominant economy for decades. So we are a society, you know, as the listener said, businesses succeed when they have workers, customers. Workers have not had their fair share in the economy, and it's high time that we resolve this problem. Progressive taxation is a key part of the solution.
Well, Emmanuel Saez is co-author of the new book, The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and he advised both Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren on their wealth tax proposals. Professor Saez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.